Hey, all you improvisers, I have got some great news for you, especially if you listen to this podcast and you've heard my voice and you're like, you know, I really like what Jimmy has to say. And I've read his blogs and I've read his books and I'd really like to work with Jimmy. Well, here's a chance to do that. I will be offering my Intro to Artist Low Comedy award-winning one-day workshop on July 14th here in Chicago. I limit this to 14 people so you'll get personal attention. If you're interested, go to my website to get more information. That's jimmycorain.com. Jimmycorain.com. If you're coming to Chicago this spring or summer and you feel stuck in your improv and you feel like, you know what, I'm just doing the same scenes over and over again and I want a new approach to improv. I want to make it fun again. I want to make it easy again. Well, then I would love it if you would think about taking my Art of Slow Comedy Summer Weekend Intensives. Now, I'll be offering them only twice this summer, July 27th through the 28th, or the weekend of August 10th through the 11th. What we work on is slowing stuff down so you can find the game easier, connecting with your partner. You get all your information from your partner about your scene work. You don't have to, like, put so much pressure. You know, when they say, oh, I'm in my head. Well, focusing on your partner helps you get out of your head. And they've got all sorts of clues, even when they're not speaking. And also, before you can be funny, you need to be real. So once you start to relax, just like when you're in a party and you're relaxed or you're with friends and you're hanging out and you're so funny and so spontaneous, same rules apply in the Artist Low Comedy. So for more information to sign up for the Artist Low Comedy Summer Intensive, the weekend of July 27th or July 28th or August 10th through 11th here in Chicago at Stage 773, go to my website at jimmycorain.com. Also, this is the first time that I'm going to be offering an advanced level two-person scene tune-up one-day workshop here in Chicago. If you feel like, you know what, I need work on my two-person scenes because that's the foundation of any long form you do, because no clever edits or walk-ons or forms are going to save you. It comes down to doing good two-person scenes. So think about it. If you're looking for feedback in your work, if you've been improvising for a long time, you're like, I just haven't gotten direction. I feel lost. I feel I need some help. Check out my workshop. That's June 1st, the Advance Two-Person Scene Tune-Up One-Day Workshop. It's Stage 773. For more information, go to my website at jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com.
Jimmy Corain's a nerd. Jimmy Corain's an improv nerd. Jimmy Corain's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Corain, and you're listening to another great episode of Improv Nerd. Our guest today is Billy Merritt. He's been performing, teaching, and directing with the UCB Theater since it first opened. He is a founding member of the improv group The Swarm and the Stepfathers in New York and The Smokes in Los Angeles. He is the co-author with Will Hines of their new book, Pirate, Robot, Ninja, and Improv Fable. We talked to Billy about what it means to improvise like a pirate, robot, and ninja, and how it can help you become a better improviser. Also, we talked to him about the four pillars of a good improv scene and what it means to him about finding the game in the scene. This book and this episode is chock full of great improv tips and information that I think you're really going to enjoy. Before we get to the episode with Billy, I just want to say I'm really proud of myself, and I'm going to pat myself on the back here. Last weekend here in Chicago, I opened up my one-person show, World's Greatest Dad? Because am I the world's greatest dad? Or was my dad the world's greatest dad? Because the show is about me becoming a dad at 52 years old, and the same time, the same year, my dad died. So it was a busy year for me, and that's what the show is about. And so I'm just glad that I can tell you that the show is up. It's got a six-week run, and because you've heard me talk about this on the podcast and write about it in my blogs, so it's up. I'm feeling pretty good about it. You know, of course, opening went really well, but didn't go, according to my expectations, which always gives me a little shame. You know, I need a little shame to feel, you know, just to medicate me to get through the good time. So enough about me. You're going to love this episode, and I'm so glad Billy took time out to do this interview with us, because this book is filled with so much great information that will help you become a better improviser. I first met Billy in Omaha, and I really loved how he improvises. I love how he teaches, and I love how he writes now. Here it is, the Billy Merritt episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Billy Merritt, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm quite excited.
Okay. It's the second time you've been on. We the last time, I think it was a couple of years ago in Omaha, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, on the stage in Omaha at the Backline Theater.
Yeah, and we got to perform together, which was great.
Yeah. I believe you were the prodigal son that returned, if that's the scene.
No, I'm from Chicago. But I'd been there before.
No, I mean in the scene itself.
Yes, and it was very fun playing with you.
Yeah.
Because your style, and it wasn't what I was expecting, UCB style. It was a little slower. Can you tell me a little about that? How you developed
it? It's not, there's a myth that UCB has one specific style, and it's such a large theater with five stages performing every night of the week on the East Coast and West Coast. There's lots of different styles with game. We choose to play more organically. When I say we, meaning the Swarm and the group I play with now, the Smokes, where we just take a word and go. Use patience to build, knowing who we are, and then from there, finding a game there. So even in the curriculum at UCB, in 101 and 201, the first 4 weeks, we don't teach premise. We teach organic, get a word, find out who you are, create that base reality, and build from there. So the roots are there. And I think Ian from the UCB 4... Ian Roberts, is a big fan of that. At least that's where I got it from, I feel.
And we've got you on because you and Will Hines have written a great book, Pirate Robot Ninja.
Exactly.
And we're going to talk about that. But what I found fascinating in the book is back in the 90s, you come from Florida. You've done some improv in New York City. And you decide to take this class with this guy, Matt Besser, who at the was one of the original UCB four. UCB it's just at that point a sketch and an improv group. It's not the school and the theater.
Absolutely.
And tell us what happens when kind of an overconfident Billy Merritt goes in there.
Yes. Well, at that time, I was over at another theater that doesn't exist anymore called the National Improv Theater in New York City. And they were in the waning days of their career. So we were looking for something new. We wanted to do long form or a thing called the Herald. And we didn't know anybody in New York that was teaching it at that time. UCB comes to town. We hear they're teaching workshops. And a friend of ours through National Improv Theater knew Matt and set up a workshop with him. And it was me and another gentleman from my group called Dave Blumenfeld. We both went to the workshop. And I feel the first half of the whole workshop was just talking about pattern game. And I'm already, comedy is a defensive art form. We protect ourselves with our comedy. So I'm already going, what is this? I don't get this. This isn't funny. I'm not laughing. There's no comedy here. And then I remember doing my very first scene. Dave and I got up and I knew it would be a funny scene because I'd probably done it before, that kind of thing, where I play a mailman that's loaded to bear with all sorts of weapons. And I got my laughs and I figured, well, there, that's a good job. And then Besser afterwards said, what was that? It's like you're improvising with blinders on. And I went, what? No, it was funny. That doesn't make sense to me. It took me several years to realize, and I left that workshop going, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. I know what funny is. I did a funny scene. There's nothing wrong with that. It took me several years to figure out that just because they're laughing doesn't mean you're doing it right. And I think that's what he was trying to get at. But with that wonderful Besser style of what you're doing is wrong. And just that's it. It taught me the lesson. It took me several years to figure it out that you just don't, first thing out of your mouth doesn't have to be funny.
So for people that don't understand that, because I know for me, when I was new, and it's when I say new, probably the first 10 or 15 years, it was like, it's got to be funny. It's got to be.
Yeah.
So what does that mean to somebody, like, you know, that's worried about, if I'm not funny, I'm going to be kicked off the Herald team?
Well, I've got a great story that I usually tell in class about this. Is it okay if I tell it?
Yeah, please.
Okay. Well, it's a podcast, might as well.
Right? Yeah, right.
I was just talking about David Blumenfeld, the gentleman that I was just mentioning. He's one of the best improvisers I've ever played with. He made me better. I've known him for years. He has since quit improv. I believe he's in a rockabilly band now, and that's what you do.
Right.
You go from ska band, long form improv, then rockabilly. That's
right, because there's more money in the rockabilly.
I think it's just for fun. He could make money if he wanted to.
Right.
But he was the kind of guy, and he was in our group, The Swarm, that if you told him a joke, he would just go, yeah, that's funny. And you'd all, like, thank God Dave thought it was funny. Now, The Swarm was a wonderful team, and we loved arguing all the time with each other about what good comedy was. I think that's what made the team so great. And at that time was our argument, just because they're laughing doesn't mean they're doing it right, or that you're doing it right. And my point of view is, no, we're comedians. I'm doing something. They're laughing. I'm doing it right. So that was my point of view. Cut to a show, and he knows I'm going to do it. And I used to do this all the time. Anytime we were in any sort of war scene, I would make light of it by pulling out finger guns, not a real object work gun, but finger guns, and just go, pew, pew, pew. Got you, fucker. And it always got a laugh. So I figured I'm doing my job. They hated that I do it. I know Dave hated it. Suggestion was something about World War II. It was a group game in the Herald. He runs out in the middle of the stage, yells, incoming, and jumps down on the floor as if he's being really bombarded by missiles and fireworks or whatever. I come out. I saunter on stage. He side-eyes me and goes, don't you do it. And it's like, I'm going to pull out my finger guns. And as soon as I pull out my finger guns, he bolts out of the ground and shoves me as hard as he can all the way to the other side of the stage. At this time, the audience is going, whoa, what are they fighting? What's going on? I thought he hit me. He did hit me in a sense. And he pushed me across all the way to the other side of the stage, then simultaneously yelled grenade and grabbed the grenade in his hand. And it blew up in his hand. And you know when a baby falls and doesn't know it's going to cry or not, and it just kind of goes, aah! He started screaming bloody murder. And I was like, what the? Oh, God. So I went from, he just hit me, to, oh, my God, I think he dislocated his wrist doing great object work. And he starts lying down on the ground, rolling around. And by this time, I figured, no, he's playing. Everybody on the back wall comes and we're all around him. I'm thinking it's maybe a Saving Private Ryan scenario where he's going to, we still don't know. There's nothing funny. Right now, the audience is not happy. They're like, what's going on? And it's like, I think he's going to like say, tell my mom I love her. Like it's going to be a long list of things to tell before he dies. So we're still all trying to predict what he's going for. And right when he says, tell my mom I grenade, and he grabs another grenade with his other hand and it blows up and he starts twirling around on stage again. And I can tell you that was the moment I said, man, we went a long way to get that, but that was 10 times funnier than pew 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 guns. And by the end of that scene, seven of us grabbed 14 hand grenades and had 14 hands blow up. So it sounds horrid, but to see it and the ridiculousness of it absolutely changed my mind as to what is, do the work to get to the funny. Don't be afraid to play tragedy till you get to the comedy on the other side. An audience will always follow you there.
Do you think that comes with a lot of bad shows and in the school of hard knocks?
It's got to. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we all have to bomb in some manner or form, and we have to learn to love it. Well, you know what? I want to take that back. Don't learn to love it. Learn to learn from it. Don't go out there expecting to bomb. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause that's been my problem. I think I've loved it too much. Let's talk about the book and, that you co-wrote with Will Hines, who is
yes.
Robot. You're a,
yes.
We'll get to that, but tell me the thing that I loved about you coming up with the term Pirate Robot Ninja is it was something as a teacher, because you were teaching at UCLA.
Yes.
Can you tell us how you discovered this? It was kind of the reaction and notes as you were giving notes to students and they were shutting down.
Yeah, you can't give the same note about a scene to all the same students. You can lay down a note of what you see. But I found over a couple of years that some people are more analytical with their creativity and some people are more impulsive. Some people need to know every single thing about that scene before they can do the next scene. These are the people that ask a lot of questions in scenes. And then some people don't need a lot of lecturing. They just need to get out there and do it over and over. And I began to realize, okay, I've got to handle these different people differently. I have to give this person a note and I need to tell this person, just get up and do it again. And it goes from the left side of the brain, right side of the brain, analytical, impulsive, and our creativity. As I lectured the class about analytics and impulsiveness, I would lose them. But if I use the word pirate and robot, we're all having fun. We got to lighten it up a little bit. You don't want to get too psychological, too in their heads, or, you know, they're just going to zone out. So it became more about fun. And then from that, I developed a pirate herald and a robot herald, which are never to be seen in public. The idea of a pirate herald is it's pure anarchy. It's not doing a bad herald. It's a herald where you are a literal pirate in the seas of the Caribbean, but you happen to love long-form improv. And you come to the Barbados Improv Olympic, and you do a show there once a month. And usually someone dies by the end of it, but it's a lot of fun. So it's a crazy yell fest herald. And then the robot herald, and that's the hardest one, is you have to take all the emotion out of it, all the issue of a problem. You can't create a problem because robots don't know what emotion is, but they want to achieve emotion. So they basically have to learn to run the program of the scene, which is, what are you doing? Who are you? What's the next move? And know all those moves because that's what they enjoy. And then at the end of that workshop, when you do both of those, then you tie them together and you have a whole person. That's hopefully the idea.
So for people that are listening, they're going, oh my God, you know, pirate, robot, ninja. Understanding. Let's break it down. Let's start with kind of player is a pirate.
A pirate is impulsive. A pirate is grounded. A pirate is the actor of the group, if you will. They provide the wind beneath the wings of the group. They're the ones that charge forward. Like I said, as the actor, they're grounded and they don't know why. Ian Roberts has an exercise called flash memory, where this reminds me of a time and place in my life. I'm going to use that in the scene. I guess it's a variation of sense memory in acting. The robot is analytical and sees the playing field and fills in all the blanks and everything that needs to be done. So if you're in a scene where you're making a sandwich and talking to each other, the robot continues making the sandwich, knows what the sandwich is, know how it takes and where everything is. They make the connections. They tie the whole thing together. They know what the form is and where you are in the form. So those are the two different types. And it's not like you're all pirate or all robot. You have tendencies towards both. But after about 10 years, after you get more and more comfortable with it, you become the ninja. And the ninja is, you use whatever you need to make this scene works and whatever group you're with. There's one group where I'm more of a pirate. There's one group where I'm more of a robot. This scene needs more pirate action. This scene needs more logic or more robot action. I forgot to say, if the pirate is the actor, then the robot is the writer, and the ninja is the connection between the two. And go ahead.
No, in terms of, what would you say, like in terms of who embody a pirate, like a Chris Farley, would you say?
Yes, absolutely, because he's absolutely happy in the space that he is on stage. I use the example of a pirate. Imagine a pirate swinging on board a ship, an enemy ship, landing in the middle with a dagger between his teeth going, ha-ha, what? And that's where a pirate improviser is happiest. They don't know what's going to happen next, and it couldn't be happier. That's what they go for. Whereas a pirate wants to see the playing field and play the playing field all the way across. They're happiest with a very simple duty to perform, cooking a meatloaf or fixing a vacuum cleaner or something like that. Or, you know what? Here's one. They love assembling IKEA furniture. That's what a robot does. They love that challenge. The ninja is the person between the two, the merging of those two elements. So the phrase I'll use in class is attack a scene like a pirate whilst analyzing a scene like a robot and edit a scene like a ninja. A ninja makes all the moves that needs to be done and never gets seen. So they're the people that you don't even recognize in a show that make the show good. And it's I think that's your end game in improv, is to get to the point where you take your ego completely out of it and you're there to make the show good, not you, which is fun in Hollywood.
Yeah. Have you ever mastered that? I mean, I've done shows where I'm like, oh my God, I was just serving the show, but those are very far and few between. But it seems like that doing this for now, I don't know, 30 years or whatever, I'm finally comfortable with, okay, if I'm just serving the show, that's enough. But that took me a long time. Where are you in that process?
Yeah, it does take a long time because, again, as I said earlier about comedy, is defensive. Your ego's involved. Good comedy, you have to be vulnerable on stage, and it's hard to get to that point. And I think after a certain amount of time, you know, I'll just use 10 years as the example. If you've been on stage solid for 10 years, you begin to realize that you're going to get your moments, you know, and it's not every time you're on stage about you. It's about the scene. And I can't think of the time when it happened for me, but I caught myself off guard going, man, I really enjoyed, this is even egotistical saying it, but man, I really enjoyed setting everybody up with those games. And I found more joy in that than getting out there and getting the laughs that I kind of knew I could. You remember the pew, pew, pew? I know I can get a laugh, but can I make other people funny? And then can I make the form that we're doing makes sense, like as if it told a whole story. And I don't know when that happened, but, and it fluctuates. Sometimes I do good, sometimes I don't. It, you know, improv's a living beast. You don't know what's going to happen with each show, but on the good shows, I tend to look that way. We just did a show, The Swarm just did a show, and I walked off stage going, I could have done better. I was tired. I should have, you know, done this or done that. And then on the way home, I thought about it. I was like, no, we told a complete story of three different groups trying to rob the same bank at the same time. Good on you. You know, it's like, good. You did a good job. You got to allow yourself to enjoy it.
Yeah, and sometimes I think that, you know, when you look through the lens of how did I do, it really colors how sometimes the show actually went.
Exactly. And that's kind of the purpose of this pirate robot is, first of all, check yourself, know who you are, know what your strengths are, so that then from a point of strength, you can work on your weaknesses, so that then you can work on the form and the show. And I think, you know, I did myself a disservice by beating myself up going, oh, this is about me. I'm being egotistical on stage. I'm trying to make this comedy about me. I should have, you know, 20 plus years ago said, all right, this is what I'm good at. So now I need to work what I'm not good at so that I can make the rest of it work. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I should have gotten into therapy 20 years ago.
Because
so much is, and I don't know if you feel this way, so much is like where you're at, you know, like how you feel about yourself.
And you have to give yourself permission to, and this is something I don't even know, I don't think I mentioned in the book, but I call them Way Homer notes. Every time you get on stage, I tell every student this after every class, every time you get on stage, no matter how old you are or how young you are to the art form, give yourself an assignment. You can't work on everything, but you can work on one thing. And then do the show. And if you do what you wanted to do, awesome. On the way home, pat yourself on the back. Good on me. I did great. Then when you get out of your car, drop it. You're not as good as you think you are. The other side is, if you didn't do what you did, beat yourself up all the way home. Why am I even bothering doing this? Then when you get out of your Prius, drop it. You're not that bad. So in other words, process the note, allow yourself to grieve and allow yourself to celebrate, and then drop it and work on the next thing. You know, and I think that's the hard part, is dropping it.
So what if you don't have a car? How does it work?
I think public transit works. I really got that off of my 30-minute ride to Jersey City from on the PATH train in New York. So it works.
All right. So
you need to have some sort of public transport.
Okay, great.
Do not Uber pool. Whatever you do, do not Uber pool.
Okay, that's really good. And people will really appreciate that.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, you talk about in this book, the four pillars of a good improv scene. And yeah. Let's start with the first pillar, which is earth. And just so people know, we're not just going to be talking about we'll be talking about the first pillar, but we're also talking about it. And that's how you captured it in this book from the robot's point of view and the pirate's point of view. So,
I feel that this is Will's side of the book, because he wanted some sort of structure, an organization. So we thought of, well, what's a good organism? What's a good thing? And he said, pillars are great. Well, what would the pillars be? And I said, Earth, Wind, and Fire is a great band. Let's use that. So we kind of started with that and then kind of pigeonholed what we talked about into it. And then we stepped back and looked at it and said, we should have been teaching this for years. It's a lot easier to pick up. What I loved about doing the book with Will is I've learned so much about the robot side, and also what pirates think of robots and robots think of pirates is very interesting. I think he gave a lot of examples for me of what a pirate is that I didn't even think about. So the pillar itself. So what was the first pillar?
The first pillar is Earth, which is creating the world, the who, what, and where. It's basically the base reality.
Yeah, the base reality, the truth of the scene. For a pirate, it is, what do you feel in the scene? Where do you feel you are? And can you get it out as far as relationship? And how quickly can you make that connection to your scene partner? I believe the exercise I mentioned in there is flash memory. I think I mentioned it before. Ian started it, and I do a variation of it. And it's honestly, it's like, if you're in this scene and it makes you feel like a time, if it's a camp, summer camp scene, and it makes you think of when you were in summer camp, well, that time had people and places and scenarios in it, and you can use that as your information, just flashes of it, to make that scene a little bit more truthful. And that's where I come from as far as grounding scenes.
So give me an example of how, if you did that summer camp scene, and then you're getting these flashes in your head about, I was in summer camp, and I drank bug juice, and it was happy time for me. How would you tap into that and use that in terms of dialogue?
Oh, okay. So it's not about your memory. You're using your memory like a buffet of specifics. I love that term. So for instance, if I'm in a summer camp scene and my scene partner goes, let's go jump in the pool. You like going to the pool? And I would mention, I remember when I was in summer camp, I jumped off the very top diving board, the high dive, and landed on my belly and had the worst belly flop in the world. So if somebody says, you want to go swimming, I'm going to go, last time I went, I hurt myself belly flopping. Could we go canoeing instead? It sounds like a no, but I'm truly invested in that scene at that moment. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, just using bits and pieces of your life that are real, and you put that into the scene, then that's a real moment. You know, you're not inventing anything. You're using something from your life. Now, it's not, like I said, you're not reliving your memories. You're simply using specifics. In my classes, I try to get specifics of names and specifics of locations more than anything else, because that's what people drop more than anything else. So I'm trying to use flash memory for people to get names out and places and locations.
And it sounds like you probably only need two or three in
a... Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. You're not a slave to your flash memory. That's, I think, why Ian says it's a flash. It's just that whatever pops in your head. There's another old book that I read. I took his workshops a long time ago. Michael Shurtleff wrote a book called Auditions.
Yeah.
And I believe in that book he talks about communication is competition. Listen competitively. In other words, be invested in what your scene partner is saying enough that you must respond, not you have to respond. He says a good competition competition is like a tennis match that goes back and forth, not where Serena Williams is beating the hell out of somebody. It's just a great volley that goes back 10, 15, 20 times, and you are competitively listening so that you can respond. One of the ways to competitively listen is go, how does that make me feel? Where does that take me in my memory? And what can I use in that memory to put into that scene? Not stay stuck in that memory. You're not reenacting. It's not therapy. It's close to it, but it's not therapy.
So we're still on the earth pillar, this first pillar. Yeah. We've talked about the pirate. Tell us, what is the robot, how they use this pillar?
Honestly, I forget what did he say? Can you give me a header?
I can't remember.
Yeah. I believe it's the facts of the location. My interpretation, and this is what I love about the book, because he'll write his interpretation of the robot version of that, and I write my interpretation of the pirate version of that, and I will politely nod my head and go, okay, whatever you think, Will. But to me, it's like, you know, in the movie form, scenic painting?
Yeah.
Or layering, scenic layering, same, what is here and what is there?
You come out, man standing, there's a guy dressed in a tuxedo, and over here...
Yeah, exactly. That's what a robot is saying. That's their internal monologue. If the pirate eternal monologue is, what does this make me feel? The robot is, there's this here. This is what this is here. This is, we see all these things. Side note, one of the reasons why the Swarm is called the Swarm is because Amy Poehler was our first director, and she made us scenic layer every single thing so that we could see it, like as an exercise. She would say, break it down, and we'd have to stop and paint like minute details of every single thing that we saw. And she would yell, swarm, swarm, get over it, get all over it. Everybody paint that picture. In my mind, I feel that's what a robot is doing. They're seeing and analyzing every single thing as it moves forward. So they know what the base reality is, and they can then act in that world, you know, the role they need to play.
It's so interesting that Amy would have you do that, because I almost think like environment and object work is a lost art.
Yes.
For people that are like, oh, you know, I just want to go up there and I want to be funny and stuff like that. What is the advantage of Amy teaching you about environment and object work and scene?
It gives you more ideas. Again, if you have a space that you can see and you can touch the space, that's going to give you more if that then what else, or add to that scene or add to that location. So the more you see it, the better it is. And it's, I call it talking head syndrome, where you'll establish the location, then your hands will drop to your sides, or you'll put your hands on your hips and you guys will just talk about the scene. And it's like, use the space, keep going to it, rest that world a little bit and explore it and use that to add to the scene. There's lots of different exercises to use with that. One of my favorite is Tennessee Williams exercise is object monologues. Start a scene, get it going, and then when you need to prove a point, look around in the room and pick up something. And so, you know, our relationship's a lot like this snow globe, and use that as an example. Anything you can do to keep reaching out to that space will further the scene along.
And then the next pillar you talked about was fire, which is the unusual thing.
Yeah. That's the main thing that I'm teaching now is like, pay attention. If you do the work we're asking you to do, and this is UCB, in 101, we're asking you to create the truth, the reality of the scene, the base reality. Once you've done that and you've done the patience that you need to do, then you need to see the unusual and call it out. So you, your scene partner, and dad in the back row who's watching the show for the first time all understand that this is what this scene is about. So you don't go past it. So seeing the unusual and calling it out is key to gameplay. If you're going to play the game of the scene or play to the unusual. There are lots of many different ways of doing that. Sometimes it's just we all know that this is unusual and we don't have to say, hey, this is unusual. But sometimes it's just picking away at something socially minor that you can turn into something bigger. I think a great example of that is Curb Your Enthusiasm. I think they take the most inane thing and you know he's going to pick at it and turn it into a giant thing. I think it's a great example.
But this is also the thing where I think people... can panic the most.
Yes.
Because
yes.
get in their heads and they're mm-hmm. looking for something. They're looking for something. What do you tell that person to be like, you know what, just relax. It will appear.
This is where I think pirates are a little bit at ease in the, if you're fully impulsive, you're at ease in that world. And it's like, great, this is where I am. And if you can truly listen as yourself, you will hear the unusual thing and you will react naturally to the unusual thing. Now, the side note to that is in real life, we spend a lot of time not calling out the unusual thing so we don't get beat up or get arrested or something like that, or just being socially polite, we don't call out the unusual thing. So I usually say play it as real as you can until you hear or feel the unusual thing, then turn into the improviser and call it out. That's when the scene starts. In other words, be as brave, braver than you would in real life, anytime you want to call that out. Now, I think on the robot side, Will uses a great example, which I now use. It's called framing, or placing the scene. If you see the scene visually, you have that, your hands create the frame like a filmmaker, and you see, boom, this is where the unusual is. Right now I'm thinking of the Terminator and that little, the visual display unit when they see their mark or something like that. I think that's what, yeah, that's what he calls framing the game. This is what the unusual is. How do we call it out? My personal opinion is you're going to feel it and you're going to know it if you're listening as yourself in that scene. You will feel the unusual thing.
Can you give us an example of a scene that you picked the unusual scene thing out, or you were part of a scene that was just so the people that are listening can get an idea of what you mean?
Yeah, let me think for a second here. I just did a scene recently. A lot of them are premise-based scenes, so you already know the unusual thing. I'm trying to think of an organic scene. The Smoke Show. We have a show, The Smokes, every Monday night, is a very organic group where we just start scenes talking to each other until it turns into something unusual. Two people, one person's going into a paint shop looking for a shade of paint. And the paint shop salesman says, we have a lovely shade of pink here. It's like, oh, well, do you have any other shades? Okay, we have violet. And now that person is going to run a pattern of all pink type light shade colors. Okay, so let's say they say, what are light shade colors? Pink, magenta, not light shade, but purplish colors, violet. And then they just go through a list of all these purplish colors. And I'm hearing that one, two, three, four. Okay, I have to stop you for a second. It seems this shop only seems to have colors of violet and purple and pink. What gives? And that's a chance right there to call out that the scene is about this paint shop only has purple colors. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and so then the player that did that then has to agree to this, correct?
Yes, yes. And then it's justification, which I think is the next pillar, which is it's all, well, I'm a big fan of Prince, or this is the only pigmentation, I'm colorblind, or mm-hmm. whatever that person says will say where the rest of the scene goes. But you need that little fulcrum, that little moment that says, hey, this is what the scene is about, and then the person says, this is one example of a scene. This is what this scene is about. And this person says, well, that's this because of this. And then we follow that track. Does that make sense?
Makes total sense. And okay. So now we're on to, that would be the wind pillar, are you saying? That the heightening, pushing?
Yeah, yeah. And this is a big argument that I have with people. Not a big argument. There's a lot of people at UCB and at other schools that you don't need justification for comedy. And I go, yes, absolutely, you don't need justification for comedy. But I'm a big fan of it. And here's why. If you all your comedy had no justification, I would be a little bored after a while. It's like kind of absurdist comedy. I guess. I don't know. my feeling is, if you're working so hard on the who, the where, the what, why not answer the why? Make the show about something or the scene about something. The justification somewhere in there is the connection from the audience to you. It's the empathy connection for them to understand, oh, I know people like that, or oh, I've been in situations like that, or I have done that myself. So I'm a big fan as a pirate of justifying the why. It's kind of like the philosophy of the scene to me.
Well, I also think too, and I'd like to get your opinion on it, it gives you, like, taking that scene you did, and if somebody said, if I was the clerk and I said, well, I actually am colorblind, now I'm giving myself a character. And
yeah,
to me, that's discovery, organically
yes.
discovering, and that is fun. And, you know, that's why we do it.
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly it. Discovering, realizing what the scene is about. Don't go in with a plan of a scene, do the scene, and walk away going exactly as planned. It's like, no, walk away going, didn't see it going there. That's fun. I mean, I think that's why we do this.
Well, and then, you know, if I discover I'm colorblind, well, maybe I have feelings about being colorblind, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, you know, I don't know. I think specifics is the rocket fuel of improv.
Oh, I agree. Totally. People work so hard on trying to get to the comedy that they forget the specifics. The specifics tie the scene together with the audience. They see the scene and it gives you clues and ideas of where the rest of the scene can go.
We got to take a quick break here and then we'll be right back after this. A lot of improvisers come from all over the world in the summer to Chicago to study improv. And I just wanted to let you know that I'd love to work with you. I've been doing these Artist Low Comedy Summer Weekend Intensives here in Chicago for about 4 or 5 years, and they always sell out. And I get such a great range of improvisers from all different countries and in the States. I like to always say the States because it makes me sound like I'm so European. But if you're in Chicago on July 27th or 28th or August 10th or August 11th, so it's that weekend, I will be offering only two this summer, the Artist Low Comedy Summer Intensives. It's really about slowing your scene work down so you can find the game easier. Before you can be funny, you need to be real. And really, I want to take the pressure off you from being funny. I really want to take the pressure off you from being funny and just learn to relax a little more, just like when you're hanging out with friends or you're at a party or, you know, you're in the car and you're just giving each other some shit, how easy it is to be funny. And that's what the Artist Low Comedy is. It's a little more mindful and it's a little more, you know, just a little more organic in your improv. So if you're looking for a new approach to improv, check out July 27th, 28th, my Artist Low Comedy Summer Weekend Intensives, or August 10th through 11th, my Artist Low Comedy Summer Intensives. They're here in Chicago at Stage 773. You can go to my website, jimmycarain.com, to sign up. That's jimmycarain.com.
And now the fourth pillar is water, which is editing.
Yeah. I edit like a ninja. Know when a scene is, know 7 seconds before the scene is dead, is the phrase I always use. You should anticipate it. Water is fluid. Water is movement. Every scene is fluid. One of the notes that I'll give, especially teaching a Herald, is everybody tends to edit at 3 minutes, 25 seconds, because that's the proper time. And it's like, not all the time. Sometimes the scene is quick. Sometimes the scene is long. Allow it to go as long as it needs to go. Quickly, the hardest part is to quick edit a scene because you're afraid you're going to hurt people's feelings. You know, even as I'm saying that, I'm realizing I'll say that, but then I'll also say, but also your first speech of your Herald should be fairly long enough to create enough material for the rest of the Herald. So everything always goes against each other. I think that's the hardest part, I think, to teach students is when to properly edit.
And what games do you have or exercises? Because I agree with you as an improviser and also as a teacher, editing is really hard to teach.
Yeah, it's you've got to just run it. Usually with classes, early level classes, 101, 201, I'm not telling them when to edit. I'm just getting them to make the move. Because I can teach you to slow down your edit, but it's very hard to get you to get in there and anticipate the edit. So like if your body jerks a little bit, you've already edited. So run across stage. And if that scene is only a minute long and it could have gone 3 minutes long, then we can work with that. We can stretch it out. Now for more advanced groups, once they've got the edit down, it's fanciful edits. It's how can we morph this scene to that scene? It's all sorts of different things. Then that's literally where the ninja came from. And it's a form that I teach sparingly because I'm scared people will get hurt doing it, called the ninja form.
Is it physically hurt?
Yeah, it's a highly physical form. If they really commit to it, they're ninjas. The form is a spotlight montage, which means the whole stage is black, except the middle of the stage is a white light circle. And in the circle, that's where scenes happen. But all the blackness all the way around is where the ninjas lurk. We literally did this show where the whole class, it was my last show in New York before I moved to LA. So I said, fuck it, let's do it. So they bought ninja outfits. They literally wore ninja outfits. 5 minutes before showtime, the ninjas came out into the audience and hid. And like we're crawling underneath the seats. They were up in the rafters. They were hiding behind curtains. The people in the audience might see somebody, might not. And they're kind of, first of all, I told everybody to come to the show high. That's important. I don't do that now. You don't need to be high to see a show. It doesn't matter. So people are going, what, did you see that? What's going on? Then all of a sudden the ninjas arrive in the center and then they ask for a suggestion. Then they break out into the ether, into the black again. Two people will start a scene. Just a normal, regular scene as themselves. They're not ninjas, but the ninjas on the outside are finding ways to kill. Those are the marks, and they must ninja assassinate them. So they have to find a way to kill them. So two people are doing a scene. One of them smoking a cigarette, and the other one says, you know, that's your fifth cigarette today. You smoke a lot of cigarettes. I'm fine. Then somebody would come out of the ether, out of the blackness as a ninja, and shout lung cancer and rip out their lungs. And then all the ninjas would come around and carry them off the stage as if a whole bunch of ninjas came and destroyed. That doesn't make any sense, does it?
No.
It doesn't. I forget. The idea is find a way to kill the scene. So what creative ways can you get in there as a ninja and assassinate these two people? So it's a highly physical form. What the form does, it teaches people, don't watch scenes from the side. Don't watch scenes from the back wall. Watch scenes from all angles. See the scene from all angles. See, hear what they're talking about. See how they're moving. So that you are in rhythm with the scene, so that you know when to end that scene. The ninja form is to create fanciful and weird edits that would theme the show. I think that's what that's about.
So getting back to this editing thing, what is a game or exercise that you teach that helps with editing?
Well, the ninja form is one.
But that's advanced people, you'd say.
I'm sorry?
You'd say that's more for advanced. Just
more for advanced people. Honestly, I don't have a pure exercise as much as just shouting, run across the stage. First thing I teach is don't let us see you edit. The first thing you do is just run from one side of the stage to the other without your hand in the air, without clapping, without commenting on the scene. In other words, you want to be seen but not seen. This is what the edit is. So we do an opening, like monologue opening, where you're coming up with ideas for a scene. After the opening is done, run across stage, okay, so that the audience has seen that. And dad in the back row is going, what was that? Why'd that guy run across stage? What happened? The second time you run across stage, dad is now going, oh, that's an editing device. I understand it now. The third time you run across stage, the audience doesn't even see it anymore. So the first thing I teach is get them to run across stage without making a big deal out of it and trusting your instincts as opposed to thinking it through. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So the only thing I really do with people from 101 to 301 is I literally shout edit if it needs to be done, or if they edit, I will go good edit. And it's kind of a process more than it is. I really don't know any good pure exercises for it.
So you cannot talk about editing without talking about walk-ons. And I got to
tell you,
And I almost feel like there is there's just been a it almost seems like there are so many edits, so many walk-ons could be edits. It's almost like control. Can you speak to that?
Again, that goes back to being a ninja, knowing when you're needed and when not. And this is why we use these examples. A ninja finds great honor in running away, just as much honor in running away and not fighting than they do fighting. And that's what you have to have in your head, is this scene could really use a walk-on because the scene needs it, versus I have something funny to say. Should I say it? And what I tend to tell people is think once, think twice, then move. Don't think once and move. Unless the scene absolutely needs it and needs that action or energy. It's like, and you'll train yourself to go, wait, is this needed or is this just a funny joke? And I think through experience, eventually you learn that not every joke needs to be told in a show. Does that make sense?
Yep. And
yeah.
The other thing I see with walk-ons is they're hijacking the scenes. And
a lot
of times, and I don't know how you feel about the percentage, but it almost seems like the show would be better off if there was less walk-ons and more edits. Am I just...
It depends on the form, but I go with that because you can always come back to the scene. If it gets edited too soon or there's more information, we can always come back to it. A walk-on on top of a walk-on is an improv jam. You know, it's, you know, it serves its purpose, but not necessarily a great thing. I absolutely agree with that. And also, can you get that information out without a walk-on? I mean, can you do it with scenic layering? Can you do it with a quick cut to or a side screen or some sort of move to get it across? Challenge yourself as opposed to just coming out and making that one thing that you think is funny. And you know what? That's a pirate move. Pirates come out whenever they think something's funny, we'll come right out and say it.
What should you be thinking when you do a walk? I know you told us the 1-2 thought, but what are you adding? I mean, certainly for a game, you know, to heighten a game would make sense. Is there any other reason that would be helpful that you're providing?
Yeah.
For walk-ons that you tell your students?
Look at that scene as a director, like you're directing or you're setting up somebody's calling me. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, okay. Look at that scene like you're a director and figure out what else does the scene need visually or information-wise as opposed to what would be funny. Does that scene need a waiter just to come in to hear the unusual conversation, not comment on it, but be an extra? Then do that. So how can you direct the scene off the back wall as opposed to how can you be funny in that scene? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Easy to say, hard to do.
Yep,
we're all doing comedy.
I'm with you, especially if you're nervous out there or you haven't been out there in a while and you're like,
exactly.
Well, here's my opportunity. There was a couple things that is reading through this book that I got that I think is just, if you're a pirate or a robot, it'd be really helpful. And that is something I think you talked about it was either in the fire or the wind pillar chapter was if the scene is boring, you talked about heightening your emotions and then confessing. Can you talk about that?
That's a great safety net move, the confession. One is, and the heightening the emotion, I think that's a Will thing. That's a very robot thing to do. It's like, when in doubt, feel something. Heighten your emotion is a great way to pick up the energy of the scene. Just figure it out there. My favorite move is the confession move, and that is, you did everything I asked you to do as a teacher, and that is keep it real, be honest, play the base reality, but nothing funny has come. You did everything I asked you to do, but you didn't create anything funny. But you've created enough information that within that world, you can confess. So two people in a scene, let's say they've been dating for a while, and the scene is just they're at a park looking at the ducks and everything's wonderful and they've created it, but nothing has happened yet. Nothing unusual has happened, and you realize I have to confess something. So you have a confession there. Now, honestly, the first thing I thought of is to say, I've been cheating on you, which sucks. I think the better confession would be, will you marry me? Like this was a confession of, I didn't bring you out here just to look at the ducks. I brought you out here because I would ask you for your hand in marriage or something like that. So a confession doesn't necessarily have to mean I murdered someone. It's just, it breaks the norm that you created there using the information that you had. So for example, that scene is, we know we're a couple, we're enjoying each other and everything's nice. So what would be a confession in that world? Why not propose marriage and see where the scene goes from there? So, does that make sense? Yeah. Yes.
And why was the first one not as strong as the second one? Because it was a
positive. It's not because I'm on a mission now to try to get people to do positive, happy improv. I'm so tired of cynical, not liking characters or scenes turning into fights. So I'm trying to make, because I do it all the time, when in doubt, what's the phrase I use? When in doubt, we bonk it on the head. We go to slapstick, or we go to, no, it's not. And I'm just on a personal mission to try to find, we can find better comedy by yesing the scene and finding positivity. And we can still find the unusual without it bogging down into arguing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You know, I don't know if it's you know, I'm doing the same thing, and I don't know if it's because of an age or because I've become a dad, but I'm just like, you know, let's do positive scenes. There's still going to be tension in these scenes. There's still going to be conflict in these scenes, but let's get positive choices. But when I was starting out, I thought, you know, reality was everybody hating everybody.
Oh, that's absolutely true. Because we have to have a little bit of cynicism as a comedian to observe society and call it out. But I also tie it into, these are the times where people are a little bit angrier than normal. The comedy has changed in classes, I feel, and there's a little bit more anger there. But conflict doesn't mean fighting, and it took me years to figure that out. Conflict means change. It means something is different from yesterday to today. It doesn't mean that we always have to fight. And trust me, this is coming from a group called The Swarm, who are master arguers. Mm-hmm. So I have every right to call this out.
But even in a scene like you just said, where, you know, two people are falling in love and the person's asking them to marry them, there is tension in there. There is in there. You know, even if you yes and it, it's like, how do they feel about getting married? Maybe they're too young to get married. Maybe they're too old to get married. There's like, it doesn't have to be, you know, you can yes and it, or maybe they're, you know, excited. Even good news, there's tension and conflict.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And it's so, look, we're not horrible people, but we want to do horrible things on stage.
Right.
But getting married or somebody proposing marriage, I try to tell people, do scenes that these characters you're creating will remember 20 years from now. Okay. This is the day I got proposed to, or this is the day I had to turn down, or we had to realize we couldn't get married today, but maybe another time. But make these scenes memorable, and you'll have a good scene, as opposed to, it doesn't have to be an argument. It doesn't have to be denial.
Right. The other thing you talked about in the book, and I thought it was interesting, I think it came up when you were going into more detail about framing and playing the, you know, reality of the scene. You don't, and this is something that I'd really like to hear your opinion on it. And I think when new improvisers start, they're just agreeing to everything. They're yes-anding everything.
Yes.
It's almost like they're popping the air out of the balloon.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because you teach them yes and, then you got to teach them, okay, don't yes and everything. Don't hyper agree beyond the unusual or what the scene is about. What was the question again? I'm sorry.
Well, I don't think there was a question. That is like, you know, when's it, you know, what is your philosophy in terms of yes and?
Yes And is about creating the reality and the truth. And once we're in sync with each other and we know who we are and we know where we are, then we want to hear the unusual and call it out. And sometimes that means asking a question, or sometimes that means, hey, you know, changing the rhythm or something like that. I think that's when Yes And gets in the way. If you Yes And each other so much, this is when you know you've Yes And too much. The scene is about planning something. It's not about being in a moment. You know, it's about, yeah, we should. Yeah, that's great. Well, what do we do? Well, let's break out the map. And then you just talk about a scene. You're not in the scene itself. And I think that's what Yes And can do.
So what would you tell people that are Yes Anding too much and how to slow it down?
And that's where framing comes in. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Framing or calling out the unusual or finding the fire is like, once you hear that unusual, stop for a second, kind of digest what's been said and go, whoa, what's this about? And there are many different ways to do that. The best example is like, hey, that's an unusual thing you just said. Why did you say that? I mean, there are many different ways to get that across. But it's almost, Yes And creates a rhythm that's hard to get out of. You just have to break that rhythm in order to find out what the scene is about. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and am I oversimplifying stuff? But maybe I am. It almost seems like all you need is a couple yes ands, and
yes,
you're fine.
No, you're absolutely right. I would never say that to a class because they will go yes, yes, and then they go right into arguing. So, you're absolutely right, though.
I always feel like we agree on the reality of the scene, whatever that is. But then inside the reality, if we're brothers and I don't drink and you offer me a beer and I say no, to me, that's not a denial.
No, not at all. That's playing the scene that you have given yourself. You know, that's yes anding the scene that you created. This is no means yes. It's not about semantics by that time. I think that gets caught in people's craws sometimes. I think it's have to say the word yes or the word and. And it's like, no, first day of class, say yes and. After that, it's just a philosophy. In the way I teach it is after you get through yes and, it's not about yes and. It's if that, then what else? Once you created that world, and now this is the unusual thing, then if that, then what else is unusual? And follow that thread as opposed to yes-anding everything in front of you.
The other thing you talked about I think is interesting is you've been teaching a long time, so have I.
Yeah.
And you're saying, and you're in L.A., I'm in Chicago, so there are different cities.
Oh, yeah.
And you're saying that the comedy is changed, the improv has changed.
Yeah.
How, in what way? From somebody who started out in New York?
Well, first of all, the difference, the audiences in New York and L.A. are different. In L.A., a lot of audience reactions to something different or risque is all, literally you hear the audience go, oh, you know, like kind of emotionally reacting or commenting on it. Whereas in New York, the audience is like go crazier, go weirder. So the audiences receive your improv differently on the two coasts. I would say, since the age of Trumpism, since that time, you could feel the audience, not the audience, the classes are a little bit more tense. There's anger in some of the comedy. And what I have to do is let's put what's going on in the real world outside of class for now, just to learn the form. Of course, when you do your comedy, you're going to use the real world. But right now, you doing scenes about being angry about what Trump is doing is going to trump literally what you're trying to learn. So I kind of put a moratorium. It's like, let's put that outside and let's just work on this and find the happiness here. Then once you get the system down, then try to add that kind of stuff.
What's our role in this angry world, certainly comedically, and also we don't really know what's the line seems to be, you know, what's politically correct, what's not. It's we're in a very kind of confusing time. What is improvisers?
I'm sorry, say it again. What was the question?
In this time where there's a lot of anger towards, you know, in comedy in terms of what's going on, in, you know, certainly some stuff that's going on in comedy, people are angry about, people in the world they're angry about. We don't you know, the boundaries seem to be fluid. We don't know what's politically correct, what's not. What's our role, you know, in improv?
I'm only talking about my role, my feel over the last few years. And I feel I've become a better teacher because of this. Is my job is to create a safe enough space in class that you feel you can be vulnerable enough on stage to hear in the whole scene and be able to react to it. So that means, adding the Me Too movement and about the racism and the sexism is we are all one. We carry each other over the finish line. And I'm a giant white man, so I'm already and I'm sassy in class. I get that. But I am happiest when everybody is totally comfortable in that class and they feel they can do what they want to do. So I do have to filter out some of the stuff that's going on outside on the inside. And honestly, it's you can see it just saying the word Trump, the whole class bristles, you know. So that's one of the things. Let's put that away for now. Let's create a safe environment and a comfortable environment, and let's see how much farther we can go. I just had a class that just wrapped up. It was advanced study. It was a Pirate Robot Ninja class, which I'm starting to teach now because I got a book.
Right.
And it was mainly, it was 60% female to male, and it was the best class I've ever had. And I thought about it last night, and it's like, God damn it. 20 years ago, I couldn't have had this class. What a waste of time. You know, it's like we could have been much more inclusive a lot earlier in our lives had we had known any better. And we should have known better. Where I am now as a teacher is better because of everything that's happening. Not, you know what I'm saying? I don't feel like I have to.
I would agree. I feel the same way. What do you do in your classroom to make people, you talked about adapting to the times and stuff. What have you done to make people feel safe and to take risks? Because you still have to take
risks. Exactly. Well, we give the speech at the beginning of class, let them know that this is a safe space. And I immediately, if anything comes across as derogatory or something that feels inflammatory, I call it out immediately. Mm-hmm. And honestly, in 101, I'll have to do that. In 401 or advanced study, I don't have to do that because everybody's gone through the system and understands.
Right.
So I feel if I do a brand new class with new people, my job is to tell them more of a big dad going, no, don't do that. Bad, you know, just so they learn. And I've had arguments in class. There was a guy in class last year that says, but my character would say bitch in the scene. It's like, yeah, but you don't say it here and now. That's all. That's all you got to do is not do that. You know, you don't even have to argue it. And he continued to argue it. And eventually he just left the class, you know, and that's one out of 1,000 students, you know, that's going to happen. But I'm not going to not do that. I wish I had done it sooner. You know, I wish I had paid attention a lot sooner in my teaching so I can get to that. Maybe it's because of my age, though, because I can yell at students now. Not yell in a mean way, but I can say, stop it. Right. As opposed to when I was younger, maybe I was more scared to be that authoritarian in class.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I just think of students, you know, that, like, for me, my approach is I'm improvising along with that they are. And really, you know, if we're thrown stuff, you know, to go with that as a teacher, because we're modeling for them improv.
Yeah. I absolutely agree with that. You know, we have to keep it safe and we can't go as far as we want to go. I feel I have to keep it safe. I can't go as far as I want some of these scenes to go, but I know that they've got a foundation. Hopefully they'll leave the class with a foundation. And once they find that group that they feel comfortable with, that they can go farther into their scene work. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm not going to get people to cry in my class. I'm not going to get them to do that because I'm uncomfortable doing it. I think there are teachers that do a great job at that. I can't get them that emotionally attached to the scene. But I feel my job is to prepare you to be able to do that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I this is just me, and I don't know, and, you know, this is in Chicago. I almost feel in the last year that the bubbles kind of burst a little on improv, but you're you're at the top there. Are you seeing that too, or is it just me in my head?
It's a little bit of that. I mean, the UCB is a bubble burst as far as you talk about yes and. My opinion, not UCB, but my opinion, we yes and everything. It's like, yeah, let's open up a second space in New York. Yeah, let's have the greatest, biggest Del Close marathon ever. And then when you step back and realize business-wise, oh, maybe we shouldn't have yes and that much. So right now, the bubble's burst in a sense of we're becoming more of a responsible financial business as opposed to, yeah, let's just create a giant improv mecca love place, you know. And I've heard that, yeah, I feel the bubbles burst, but I also feel it's not like the bubble burst in stand-up comedy in the 80s and 90s. I don't think it's that big of a burst. I just think we grew to a certain point, and this is the point that we're going to be at. Now, my response to that is we have to quit doing improv for other improvisers. We have to quit doing improv shows that only improvisers watch, and we do inside jokes for improvisers watching improv. We have to remember that we're doing improv for people who have never seen it before, and we have to teach them what they're watching as they're watching it, and they have to learn. You have to teach them to love it as much as you love it.
Well, so that you bring up a really good point, because this is what I've felt for a long time, and I know you've toured around the country teaching as well. Yeah. Anytime I go into a town, it's always short form does really well, and short form plays to a mainstream audience. In my experience with long form, people will say in those towns, those smaller markets, and I think it's true even for the bigger markets, short form sells, long form doesn't. We didn't get much of an audience for long form. Long form isn't as accessible to the mainstream audience. A lot of the audience that goes to see improv shows, across the board, especially long form shows, there's exceptions, genre show or TJ and Dave, but for the most part, it's improv audiences. And how can long form get bigger? Because that would be great and appeal to a mainstream audience.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I'm a pusher of that big time. When I hear that short form sells and long form doesn't, I'm going, well, then maybe we're not doing it right. Maybe there's a way to connect to the audience. One thing is, like I said before, the indie scene and long form, improvisers love long form, so improvisers perform for other improvisers, and they forget that what they're doing, a regular audience, that's dad in the back row is the phrase I always use, doesn't know what's going on. So you got to gear it towards them. And stuff that I used to hate is something I think we need to do. Something that I used to hate in improv, I called it gimmick prov, would be audience interviews. Interviewing the audience and then improvising off of that interview. I have grown to realize, well, that's how an audience would come back to your show again if they tell their friends that, oh, they interviewed me, then they put my life up on stage. It was exciting. That's one example. Is we have to make you can't just say it's not accessible and then leave and that, that's it. Have to make it accessible.
We're artists and screw them. And that's how I started. Fuck them.
Oh, me too. It's like, no, they will come to us. We don't need to come to them. Well, no, we need to come to them if we are going to keep growing. If this is going to be a valid art form, then we need to make it accessible, not, just for us.
Is there anything you do in your shows that does make it more accessible to a mainstream audience?
Having said that, no, I just take a word and go because I'm so used to it. I think there's that connection with the audience up front. I always get the suggestion up front from the audience in the smoke show. And I just do. It's not a long I know ASCATs are infamously famous for the long audience host interactions. Mm-hmm. But I honestly feel just that 1 minute of interaction with the audience up front will bring the audience into your world a little bit more. Then the next thing is, as an improviser, can you create things on stage that the audience can empathize with. Like, I've been in that situation. It's like, I know what he's talking about. Not creating, and this pains me, but not creating wizards and dragons right away. Mm-hmm. You know, create real life, let it build from there, and then heighten to the wizards and dragons, if you will. Don't start big. Let it build. Be patient. Let them be on board. And then you can take them on a journey.
You know, as I was reading the book, I started to think to myself, not only as a teacher, but as a performer, that really this book is to understand there's people learn differently, people approach improv differently, and that's kind of needs to be understood because as both as a teacher and a performer, sometimes they're getting who I am and my experience and how I look at things. If I'm a robot, they're going to get a robot experience. If I'm a pirate, they're going to get a pirate experience.
Exactly.
Was that the reason you wanted to write this book? To like, okay, let's, this isn't only for improvisers. This really is for teachers. Like, we all learn a different way.
Yeah. That's absolutely it. You know, I think the big deal, I mean, all the teachers, oh man, I could just go on and on about this, but
please do.
Yeah. Take as many different teachers as you can, learn all their, take everything that they're teaching you, then make your own decision as to how you want to play. That's my end game note. By 401, it's like, I'll ask people, what shows did you see? Why did you like it if you liked it? And if you didn't like it, why didn't you like it? Don't shit talk it. Just tell me what about it was not for you? What about it was for you? If you like a teacher, why did you like that teacher? If you didn't like a teacher, why didn't you like it? If kind of analyze, that's part of the way Homer note. Why is this working for me? Why isn't this working for me? So you can kind of shore up who you are and where you're from as an improviser. And then go from there. I've been very fortunate to have a lot of different acting teachers with different styles down in Florida and then up in New York. And they've all come from different points of view. I was very fortunate for my very first acting teacher. He has since passed away, Frank Leahy in West Palm Beach. I just want to give a shout out to Frank. And he gave me the first term, use what you need from different styles of theater to do the scene that you need to do right there. And it kind of put me on my journey of, learn Meisner, learn this, learn that, learn all the different styles so that when I'm in a scenario, when I'm in a scene, or when I need to create a character, I can pull from any of those, not just from one style. And I think maybe, I don't know, I think the UCB has gotten the mark of being a very premise-based group, and we are very premise-based. Some of the teachers are, but more than half the teachers are organic-based, like take a word and go type player, more slow play. There's a lot of shows that are like that as well. So when I tell people to see shows, see a bunch of different shows, see what works for you so you know how to study, so you can get good at what you're good at, then you can work on what you're not good at, which is literally what the whole book is about.
Well, also, I think of all, and you were talking about being on the swarm and arguing with people, like, stage, and like, being pissed off, maybe it's usually not expressing it because I'm passive aggressive, but I'd hold on to the resentment, go, oh, that choice, you know, that. But really, if you're identifying, here's a pirate, here's a robot, here's a ninja, we're not going to make the same choices, and that's a good thing. Our goal is to just accept the choices they make and then use them.
Exactly. And that's all part of being comfortable who you are. You know, stand in the place that you are. I think that's an R.E.M. song. Yeah, why not?
In the place that you are. Yep.
Yeah, I got it.
Okay.
I think I know I was uncomfortable with that. I when I consider myself a pirate, I only thought of the bad things that a pirate did, not the good things. And I think it's part of, you know, kind of be proud of what you're doing, then you can grow, as opposed to not being proud of what you're doing or being. Does that make sense?
Yep.
I think that's what I'm trying to say.
Well, we got to wrap this up. This is great, and you got to check out the book. And where can they get a copy of the book?
It's on Amazon.com. I think you've heard of it. Pirate, Robot, Ninja, and Improv Fable. The other one thing we didn't mention is it's told as a story as opposed to just preaching all the... I mean, we have things that we wanted to work out, but we want to tell it as a story as opposed to just like a textbook. So keep that in mind, that it's a improv dojo up in the mountains in Tibet somewhere. And I think that's the fun part for me of writing that.
Why did you decide to do it that way?
I think Will kind of got us. He wrote a book, a great book, before, How to Be the World's Greatest Improviser.
Yeah, it's great.
And he even said it. He looked at me right in the eye and says, people I know bought the book, but they didn't read it. And it's like, oh, I bought the book. Did you read it? No. And then I had to go ahead and read it because, you know, I skimmed it and looked for my name in the book.
Right, yeah. Mine's in there twice, I think.
Yeah, and I think it took us a couple months to make this realization, but I think it was Will who kind of said, oh, improv books can get a little wordy, a little heady, especially if you're just talking about improv theory. You can kind of lose people. And I think I'm the one being a pirate, so, well, why don't we make it like a dojo or like an improv school or something like that, like a text adventure. You show up at the doors and what's in front of you type thing. And it's really just a device for getting our ideas across. Eventually we're going to have action figures so you can act it out. No, not really. I lied. We're not going to have action figures.
Well, and we usually don't look for action figures, but do look for Pirate Robot Ninja on Amazon. And
yes.
So we always end the podcast the same way. What is one thing you'd say to an improviser starting out today?
Starting out today?
Mm-hmm.
Allow yourself to listen. Don't listen. Allow yourself to listen.
What's the difference?
Drop all preconceived notions of what the scene is going to be about and allow yourself to hear what your scene partner says so that you can react to that honestly. Once you get that, everything else becomes so much easier.
Any exercise or any advice how to do that?
I think the flash memory exercise of say a word. Let's say if I tell you vacation.
Mm-hmm.
A vacation makes you think of the first thing that you see in your mind right now.
Station.
On vacation.
I see an old 1976 Impala station wagon.
Is that a family station wagon?
Correct, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So can you think of an opening line of dialogue using that, what you visualize? Like, who are you? Who would you be talking to? What would you be saying?
Kid, and I would say, I'd like to sit in the front seat with Dad.
That's it. That is all you need to start a fantastic scene. You don't have to have a premise. You don't have anything like that. And now you're also emotionally invested in the scene. You allowed the word to wash over you, and that made you see a car, which made you see your dad, which also made you see a great want. That's very simple. It's like, I'd just like to sit in the front seat. And unfortunately, I'd be in the scene and I go, no. And I would ruin the whole scene. No, I wouldn't. I would say, you know what? Today of all days, why don't you get in the front? It's time for you to be a man. And then eventually you'll be driving that car.
Well, that's great, because that's how I already planned it out. So
you're such a robot.
Yes, I am. And thank God, because I felt during the whole interview, it's like I'm a robot and I'm interviewing a pirate.
Yeah. If we were in the same room, I'd have to kill you.
Yeah, you know, really quickly, I want to keep going, just one more question. What happens when you get out there and I'm playing with another robot or you're playing with another pirate and it's not going? It's like, I've done 100 scenes where it's me and another robot, you know, and they die.
Yeah.
Bermuda Triangle of improv. What do you do to make that adjustment? Like, if you're working with another pirate and you're not getting enough information, what do you do?
Confess. Go back to confessing. If it's like going herky jerky, you don't know what, like, stop the whole scene and go, look, I got something to tell you right now. I'm holding a knife, you know, or something that's just weird and bizarre. Hopefully it's something that's from the scene.
Okay.
But that's the first thing that pops in my head. When in doubt, confess something. And that makes the scene about the confession. And that kind of steers everything towards the confession. And then from there, who knows where the scene's going to go? It might lead to another confession, or it might lead to results of the action. Who knows?
Billy, that is, that's so helpful. And, do you ever feel weird? I'm thinking here are two, you know, old guys, two old white guys. All they do is talk about improv. They love talking.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel like I feel like I love this conversation, but there's a part of me like, you know, it's, we're recording this on a Monday, you know, noon your time, 2:30 my time. It's like, what have I gotten myself into?
Yes. That's an everyday notion. Sure. But also I'm kind of in a good place now where I'm just going, man, am I lucky to do this? As opposed to a 9-to-5, or before I even got into this in my mid-20s, I was a restaurant manager, and I couldn't think of, this sounds mean to restaurant managers, but a more horrible life than running a Red Lobster in Florida. In retrospect, that's not so bad. I'd probably have a boat. Things would be going well.
Was there a lot of pain? You know, I worked in restaurants.
Yes.
Okay, great. Just it happened in the independent the chains as well, right?
Yeah, it happened everywhere. Honestly?
Yeah.
Yeah, acting saved my life. Once I got into theater, I couldn't afford cocaine anymore. So that's why I stay with improv, so I don't buy cocaine.
Wow. That's a good way to end, isn't it? It's a good note for listeners.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure. And hopefully our paths will cross again and we'll get to work together, because I really liked,
absolutely
liked your style. And you know, I you know, have so much respect for you as a performer and a teacher, and now as an author, you know.
Oh, yeah, right?
It hasn't gone.
Jimmy, I always love talking to you.
Yeah, it hasn't gone to your head being an author, has it?
Not yet. Give me a month, and we'll see how I'll start wearing a beret or something.
Okay, so the next time you write another book, I'm going to have to probably go through your publicist to get an interview.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right, check the book out, Pirate Robot Ninja. Buy it on Amazon, written by Billy Merritt and Will Hines. You can't get two nicer people, more passionate about improv, knowledgeable about improv. You're going to really, really love this book. That's it, Billy. Thanks so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Thanks for having me.
And there you have it. Another great episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. And I want to thank our guest, Billy Merritt, from Los Angeles on this phone interview. And go out and buy his new book on Amazon, Pirate Robot Ninja, an Improv Fable. And it's written by Billy Merritt and Will Hines, another great improviser and improv teacher from the Upright Citizens Brigade. I'd like to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you would not be hearing my voice right now. And for more information about me, Jimmy Corain, the host of Improv Nerd, about my classes, my award-winning classes, The Art of Slow Comedy, or if you want to bring me to your school or your corporation or whatever, go to my website, sign up for my newsletter and get my blog. All you have to do is go to jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. And please follow us on social media. We have an Improv Nerd Facebook page. Please like it, because it helps my low self-esteem. Twitter, we're at improv_nerd. And we are now on Instagram. They just told me we're on Instagram. And it's my name, just Jimmy Corain. And then, of course, the Patreon, where we do, we have little master lessons. You can sign up and you can get full filmed episodes of Improv Nerd for a low, low monthly fee. That's it. Thanks so much for listening. And until next time, walk, don't run.